The Beatles, One After 909. John Lennon had said that he wrote that as a teenager when he was like 17 years old, and then Paul McCartney chimed in. They recorded it. The Beatles recorded it in 1963, but it never made it onto an album until Let It Be, released in 1970. Great tune, though. You know, some years ago, I basically gave up on Roswell. Seemed to me that, and probably to many of you, that it was like beating a dead horse. I mean, how many times can you look at Roswell? And what's worse, at the time, the main investigators couldn't seem to agree on anything. There was no baseline of mutually accepted facts. So, you know, when was the crash? There were different answers to that. Where was the crash? Was there one crash or two? Were there bodies? How many bodies? Different researchers would defend different theories. Different witnesses would be defended. And the disagreements grew pretty heated at times. But then, you know, the Air Force came out in the late 90s, might have been 97, 98, with an even more bogus show-and-tell dog and pony show with its Roswell report case closed. Such an outright travesty on so many levels that I found myself rooting once again for the Roswell guys, the investigators. These days, they seem to have made peace among themselves. They agree on the basics. Something really did crash, something that was not ours, something out of this world. And a cover-up was instituted. The cone of silence was dropped over the whole thing. You know the basics of the story, or do you? The Children of Roswell is the new book by Tom Carey and Don Schmidt, a seven-decade legacy of fear, intimidation, and cover-ups, and it puts a human face on this story in a way that hasn't been done before. In a moment, Carey and Schmidt talk about the latest Roswell research. I think you're going to like it. Stay with us. Much more to come here on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast. Don Schmidt is the former co-director of the J. Allen Hynek Center for UFO Studies, where he served as director of special investigations for 10 years. Prior to that, he was a special investigator for the late Dr. Hynek for the International UFO Reporter, and he's done so much work on the Roswell story. His work was largely responsible for Roswell, the film that came out and caused a lot of ripples. Tom Carey has been a mutual UFO Network State Section Director in Pennsylvania, also a special investigator for the Hynek Center and a member of the CUFOS Board of Director. He began working on Roswell in 1991 along with Kevin Randall and Don Schmidt, and then the two of them have worked together on three previous books. Their newest work is The Children of Roswell. Guys, welcome back to the program. Really good book, really good work.
Thank you, George. So great to be back with you again.
Thank you, George. Nice to be with you this evening.
Tell me this. Yes, this morning. How often do you get this kind of a reaction? Oh, no, Roswell again. You're beating a dead horse. There's nothing new. Please give it a rest.
Well, it's like that old George Carlin line about, oh, no, you're not going to talk about this again. And then he goes, well, yes, I am. But tonight it's going to be from an entirely different perspective, as you were explaining, George, from the families, the loved ones, you know, those forced to coexist within the government's confines of a cover-up, and they all share one common trait, and that's the fear, the intimidation, and watching a loved one live out a life of government suppression. And when they also knew of facts not supported by official explanations, they also became, you know, targets of that same suppression. And so we're dealing with witnesses that we often had to rely on in the face of fathers, spouses, who still refuse to talk. They still honor their oaths of secrecy. And all we could talk to were the children, the wives. And we finally realized, not only in the face of, you know, the growing attrition rate of the World War II generation, we're losing the last bastions of truth regarding this 1947 incident. And all we have left are the families. But they, too, have a story. They, too, have lived out, as I mentioned, you know, a lifetime of knowing other details, having had personal involvement, and now we have provided them with an opportunity to finally speak out.
Tom, was it always your intention to put a face on it in this way? Did you know that this is where the research would lead? You know, you're telling an angle that's always been there to some degree. But it's fresh. It's such a fresh approach to it. And I just wondered if you knew this is where it was going to lead.
No, we didn't. It was sort of an evolution, George. because most of the original participants, the Greatest Generation, are gone now. And over the years that we've been investigating this, and Don has got a few years on me. I've been investigating it for the last 25 years, and I think Don for about the last 27 or 28. So, and this is the only case we've been investigating, but as we've gone along, the original participants have passed away, and we increasingly were talking to the children and now the grandchildren, and they all had a story to tell that was, as you say, fresh. And it sort of evolved that way just on its own progression. But to answer your original question, George, if I could have a crack at that.
Sure.
You know, the oh no, not Roswell again. I hear that mostly from other investigators who are in some other area of UFO research. Like, oh my goodness, you're not still on Roswell. And what they really mean is, oh, geez, if you talk about Roswell, it's going to suck the air out of the room, because most of the people I've run across are still interested in it, especially new information. So it's sort of a, I don't know, sort of a double-edged sword there. They're interested, but they don't want to be that close to it, because I got into this 25 years ago, never thinking that here we are 25 years later, I'm still as interested today as I was way back when I first got going on Roswell as an active investigator.
And so, still finding new stuff. We'll get into this specifically a little bit later, but, you know, you talk to so many witnesses who share bits and pieces, sometimes the entire story, and you have a whole bunch of other people that don't tell you anything. The fact that they refuse to talk, that they're terrified, that they go to some extreme lengths to avoid you, that also speaks volumes.
Well, and Tom would confirm this. Even since the book has been out, just within the last couple of weeks, we are exchanging leads. We are talking about additional witnesses and even possible firsthand who are, albeit in their late 80s, early 90s, we find them, and then with the hope that we'll get some final statement from them. So I know other colleagues have suggested, well, how many more witnesses, how many more interviews do you need? Well, we are presently over 600 first and second hand, either directly or indirectly involved. So I guess the question is, well, how many more do we need if we were to go into a courtroom and present all this, you know, circumstantial, albeit eyewitness testimony? And clearly, for the greatest story of the millennium, enough will never be enough. So our investigation still remains fluid in the context that as long as they're still out there, we're still hunting. We're still going to find you.
Well, you never know which witness is going to have a little piece of metal that would establish definitive, undeniable evidence.
That's another book of all the false alarms. Yes.
Well, we'll get into that the search for the metal in a bit. I wonder, Tom, if maybe you could establish the baseline for us on which facts we can agree, which version of the Roswell story. Just kind of give me the laundry list of what the general public, and in particular the most seasoned investigators, now agree on, because at times there have been disputes about some pretty basic stuff.
That's an easy answer, George. It's our version. No, as you said earlier, 25 years ago, we're talking now the early 90s, there were a number of different versions. What was the crash date? Who was involved? Where was it? How many crash sites are there? Was it the plains of San Augustine? Was it somewhere else? Well, our investigation, and I have to believe that, we've been told that our books on the Roswell case are the best ever written. Not to pat ourselves on the back, but maybe just a little bit. We put together, based on Don and my investigation, a framework that we said this is where it happened, this is how many sites there were, and we finally zeroed in with the help of others on the exact date of the crash. And all of the witnesses that we have gotten since then to our satisfaction, all of their testimonies have fallen within that framework. And here it is. The crash was actually an explosion of an extraterrestrial craft, or as they called it back then, an interplanetary craft, late in the evening of July the 2nd, 1947, up near the town of Corona. It was either an internal explosion or an external explosion. If it was external, most likely it was a lightning strike during the monsoon season in New Mexico in July. And we believe there were five occupants in the craft. Four were dead, four were killed, and one survived the crash. We believe there are actually three sites involved. The so-called, the one site that everybody agrees on, the Brazel Ranch, the J.B. Foster Ranch, debris field site. That's where the ship exploded, and all this debris rained down into the Mac Brazel sheep pasture, which he came across the next morning. There was also a site 2.5 miles east of that site where we believe two of the occupants were blown out of the ship during the original explosion and met their fate on a low bluff 2 miles east of the debris field site. And finally, there was an inner cabin or an escape pod of some sort that withstood the crash and came to rest 35 miles further on from the debris field site, much closer to Roswell, where two were found dead and the one that was alive was found also. The Roswell story was a two-day story back in 1947. The first headline that came out, the first press release, was that the Air Force had recovered, they said the RAAF, the Roswell Army Airfield near Roswell, had recovered a crashed flying saucer. They used the term captured, which it certainly wasn't. It was a crash. And the very next day, the headline was, folks, sorry, it wasn't a flying saucer or an interplanetary craft. It was a weather balloon. And that was the end of the story for the next 30 years until the civilian investigators reopened the case in 1978. And the first book by William Moore and Charles Berlitz, Stanton Friedman was also an investigator with William Moore on that, came out 2 years later in 1980, called The Roswell Incident. So in a nutshell, that's the evolution of the case. Don Schmidt and Kevin Randall came along in 1987, 88 to reopen the case, and I got on the case in 1991 with the Randall and Schmidt team.
Let's play What If for a second. I'm sure you guys have gone over this in your head a million times, but what if you had been around back then? Or what if major media, investigative reporters, gumshoe detectives back in those days, what if they hadn't bought that cover-up story and had dug into it then when it was fresh? This mystery could have been solved, couldn't it? Maybe both of you take a crack at that.
Interesting you mentioned that, George. In fact, in 1998, actor John DeLancey, who played Q in the Star Trek Next Generation series, and I had done a number of sci-fi conventions with him, and the thought, because he was doing alien voices with Leonard Nimoy at that time on Turner Broadcasting, the radio dramatizations of War of the Worlds and First Man on the Moon and Lost Horizon and all that, and it just came to me one day, what if we were to do some type of radio dramatization about Roswell and time compress it into one day and the whole story evolving around what if Mac Brazel and then all the other witnesses didn't go to the military, didn't go to the authorities, but rather went to the press. How it would have changed the whole story. How this would have just had a life of its own to the point that there would have been no containing it, no covering it up. And just the irony that it was presented, dropped right in the lap of not only the military, but the most elite military unit in the world at that time, the 509th Bomb Group, in charge of the atomic bomb. And as a result, their last word was the final word on it. When they put out the retraction that it was nothing more than an off-the-shelf weather balloon device, the press accepted it. and the people were certainly ready to, you know, rest, you know, peacefully that night, thinking once again that, especially just immediately after World War II, that the last thing they wanted to deal with was the possibility of an invasion from outer space, that we were dealing with a force with a power that surpassed our own. So in many ways, it was the answer that they needed at that time. But the fact that it took 30 years for it to finally spring forward, the intelligence officer, Jesse Marcel, when he was dying of emphysema, and you certainly know that story, George.
Yes.
Of how he finally, you know, realized he had been the patsy. They always told him, Jess, you know, in 5 years, it's all going to come out. 10 years, 15 years. 30 years later, he realized they were not going to release the truth. They were not going to set the record straight. And that's when he started this whole ball rolling to the point that, as we've been saying, any court of law, we would win this hands down.
Tom, same kind of question. I mean, you must have played it over in your head. Man, if I could have been there in 1947 when all these witnesses were young, when it was going on, before the cone of silence was dropped, we could have busted this wide open.
Yes. In fact, George Wilcox, the sheriff of Chavez County, which was based in Roswell, when we interviewed his daughters, he had two daughters, they said that before he died, he said his greatest regret was that he directed Mac Brazel, that's the rancher who found the debris and came to town, he directed Brazel to the base, the Air Force base south of town. He said if he had it to do over again, he would have called the media first. Then the story wouldn't have gotten covered up. It would have gotten out, and they couldn't stop it. Now, like Don says, maybe it was in 1947 that the Cold War had just begun, and the flying saucer, the UFO phenomenon, had also begun 2 weeks prior to the Roswell crash. So people were confused as to what was going on. These lights in the sky, things flying around, our fighter jets couldn't overtake. They were confused about what's going on here. And
especially in New Mexico.
Especially in New Mexico, with all of the atomic research going on, and then research with V-2 rockets and the like. So the question was for the Air Force, what do we do? We've never encountered anything like this before. Do we cover it up, or do we get the story out? Now, the explanation that I like, and I of course I wish the story had gotten out, because we believe that it was the crash of an extraterrestrial craft, and we would be almost 70 years into knowing this. But the explanation that I like is the one that given by Major Patrick Saunders before he died. He was actually the base adjutant on the Roswell base, and before he died, his daughter was talking to him about this incident, and she learned that he was actually the one that started to vacuum the files on the base of anything having to do with this, and he was very proud of that, starting the cover up, the destruction of records. And she asked him, "Well, Dad, why was it covered up?" And his answer that I just find very poignant, he says, "We were faced with a technology greater than our own, and we didn't know what their intentions were." So when you have that sort of situation, until you find out what it is, you cover it up. At least that's the military mindset. You cover it up until we find out what it is. And it suggests, since they're still covering it up today, maybe they still don't know.
Well, when I said, especially in New Mexico, the context I meant was it was more UFO sightings and reports than anywhere else, maybe in the world at the time.
That's correct. In fact, according to, as you mentioned, Project Blue Book, there were more UFO sightings through New Mexico at that time. And as Tom had mentioned, not only, I find it still fascinating that, especially on college campuses, when you ask where was the first atomic bomb detonated, and after you tell them it wasn't Japan, and that it was actually in the United States, it was in New Mexico, they're still scratching their heads like, we didn't know that.
And Don Schmidt and Tom Carey, sorry to interrupt you there, Don. My guest, Tom Carey and Don Schmidt, author of the new book, The Children of Roswell. We'll be back in a moment. U2 takes us into the break. From 1980, Pat Benatar, I'm Going to Follow You. I figured this song was a little bit fitting, considering what the witnesses to Roswell went through, they and their families. They can relate. They were followed. Their phones were tapped. Threats were made. Searches were conducted. All kinds of stuff that we would consider illegal was done to them and might still be being done to them. We're going to hear some specifics from my guests, Tom Carey and Don Schmidt, right after this on Coast to Coast AM. You know, there's a perception, I think, among the casual followers of the Roswell story that not many people, very few people, in fact, are known to have handled any of the wreckage. That Mac Brazel, the rancher who found the debris field, he handled it. He calls the military. Jesse Marcel is sent out there. He brings some home. His son, Jesse Marcel Jr., sees some of the stuff, plays around with a little bit. But other than that, there aren't many names that for sure we know saw this stuff. Maybe the biggest surprise of this new book, The Children of Roswell, Don Schmidt, for me, is how many people got a chance to see that stuff out there in the desert. It's just amazing. You have this perception that the military clamped down, they kept everyone away. But before the military got their act together, a whole bunch of people were out there looking around and took samples.
Absolutely, absolutely. In fact, by having determined that the crash took place on July 2nd, the debris field is first discovered the early morning of the 3rd. He doesn't even report the find until Sunday, July 6th, to the Chavez County Sheriff. And then Marcel and a counterintelligence officer, Captain Sheridan Cavett, don't actually make it to the site to the next morning, Monday the 7th. So that material has been out there for 4 or 5 days. And one of the things that we observed very early into our investigation is because this is a such an isolated region, territory of the country. Kevin Randall and I, the very first time we were out there, it was like going to the moon. You're talking about an area that did not even receive phone service until 1986. And back in 1947, with no running water, no electricity, no contact with the outside world at all, except to get into your pickup truck and drive to the nearest populated area, once word did get out, and Brazel, in his effort to come up with any explanation, because not only was this material so bizarre, so unusual, there was also so much of it. It covered an area of almost 3/4 of a mile long, much more than this ongoing suggestion, even by the military, that he picked up just the remnants of a balloon that he could have gathered up by himself, tossed into the back of his truck, and that would have been the end of it. But the first thing he was concerned about was who was going to clean it all up. He couldn't even get his sheep to cross through the area to get to their water. He had to drive them 2 miles around. And as he would go to his neighbors and then into Corona, the nearest town, we have descriptions from Wade's bar where they were passing pieces of the wreckage from one end of the bar to the other, everybody trying to cut it, burn it, bend it, have any effect on it, and all with total failure. And to the point, everybody was out there seeking souvenirs and, you know, taking away pieces that would later be confiscated by the military. As we've heard these people describe, even the systematic attempt by the authorities to retrieve every last piece of physical evidence. And this went on not just for days or weeks, it went on for years after the event, because they were so concerned about the physical evidence leaking out again to the press.
Tom, how many people would you guesstimate were out there and saw the debris field and perhaps grabbed a piece?
Well, you know, George, as Don says, this is a remote region of New Mexico, and whenever there was a crash of a light plane or a military plane of some sort, it's always the civilian ranchers, their families, the children, the fathers, the mothers that are out there first, before the military ever gets there. And so we have a number of ranch families out there. So to actually put a number on it, we'd have to sit down and start going through the names. But there's scores of people that we have come across who either saw the wreckage themselves or knew somebody who saw the wreckage and had described the wreckage to them. So that's...
Well, let's start going through some names. Let's start going through a few. You take a couple, and Don can take a couple. Which ones, Tom, you think are most credible, whose stories stand up to scrutiny?
Well, of course, one of the children of Roswell, one of the first that we interviewed, was a woman named Frankie Dwyer Rowe.
Yeah.
She's still alive today, one of the few that are, that were actual participants who is still alive. She was 12 years old in 1947. She's 81 or 82 today. Her father was a city fireman, and she had gone into Roswell at the time of the incident to have a dental appointment. And after the dental appointment, she went to the firehouse to wait for her father to come by. He was out at the time, come by the fire station and take her home. Well, while she was there, a highway patrolman named Robert Scroggins had come in. He lived in Hobbs, New Mexico, south of Roswell. He's on his way home. He comes in the door and says, "Hey, everybody, take a look at this. Tell me what you think it is." He reaches in his pocket, and he wads up something in his hand, and he holds it out over the table and opens his hand, and unfurls this silvery piece of something. It looked like metal. It could have been cloth, but it's just floating ever so slowly down to the table. And somebody says, "Do that again. Do that again. What is that?" So he does it again, and then it goes around to everybody that's in the firehouse at that point, including Frankie Rowe. And she has a real good description of holding this piece of metal, let's call it. It looked like aluminum, very thin aluminum, but she said it had no weight, and you could roll it up in your hand and open your hand, and it would just unfurl and run out like water, just like water on the table. And she did that a couple times, and her description is so graphic that, we still don't have anything like that. So that's the first name that comes to mind. There are a number of others, new ones in the book. We talk about in one of the chapters, Houdini who made a spaceship, a flying saucer, disappear. This was a six-year-old boy.
Oh, yeah. That's a great story.
Yes, six-year-old boy. His father had been a dispatcher. Near the base, just outside the base, near the big hangar where all the wreckage had been taken, was a railroad spur where the railroad cars would come by. They'd load things in, and off they'd go. And he was the dispatcher who sort of accounted for everything that was to go into the railroad cars. He was a civilian, and this one day during the incident, he was told to get there real early as the Air Force was going to ship something in one of the railroad cars. And so as it turned out to be pieces of the wreckage. They had put them in boxes, but the box was open. Boxes were open at the top. And he could see these aluminum-looking pieces of metal sticking out. So he says, "Geez, I wonder what that is." And so they load these boxes into the freight car, but one of the pieces drops off and onto the ground, and the military people didn't see it, so he kept his eye on it, and he had them sign the sheet, and off goes the train, and the thing heads east. And so after the military had gone back into the base, because this was just outside the base, he went over, he found the piece, and he looked around, and he crunched it with his foot into the dirt, so that nobody could see it. He came back later, got it, and he kept it hidden in his house for some time. And his six-year-old son, he had this little, his son was into magic. And for his sixth birthday, his father presented him, and he wrapped it in a box and with a bow, and he presented him with this piece of metal. It was what we called memory metal, the kind that Frankie Rowe just described. And he said, "Oh my God, what is this?" And his father said, "Well, it's something special that your daddy found at the crash found somewhere at a crash." Well, the son, he says, "I'm going to use this in my magic show." And his father says, "Well, we have a wood, you know, you can use that wooden shed out in the back for your clubhouse for your friends and to put on your magic show." So the topper on his magic show, the final little piece of entertainment, was he would pull out this piece of memory metal and wow everybody with its properties. And so he did this a few times, and he made the mistake of keeping the memory metal in the clubhouse, this little wooden shed. And as the chapter says, people were watching, because at some point adults started showing up to the six-year-old magic show. And somebody in there was observant, because one day they went to have the magic show and the piece of metal was gone. Apparently, they reported it to the police, but they were never able to identify the perpetrator of the theft. And so, somebody, word gets around, and who knows, that it perhaps got to the airbase, and
somebody snagged it.
But we've had so many stories. Don can tell you a few that. Well, there was a piece of metal in the family, but where is it today? Well, we don't know.
Well, there are a lot of examples in the book of where the military specifically came and ordered people to give it up. We'll get into some of those in a moment. Don, I want to have you tell the story about the Brazels. Mac Brazel's the rancher who finds it. Wouldn't he keep a bunch of it? I guess one thing that your book, The Children of Roswell, does is correct some misperceptions about who was with Mac Brazel and what might have become of any samples that were collected by he and the boy who was with him.
Well, the skeptics always like to cite the July 8th, 1947 article, the interview with Brazel, and describing how his wife Maggie and his son Vernon and daughter Bessie were all with them. And keep in mind when we've been describing how desolate, how isolated, and the Brazel home actually was in Tucumcari. The idea that why would you have your family out at a ranch house without any utilities, without any conveniences of the time, when you actually had a home, you know, an hour away? So that in itself was a misnomer. And then when we learned that it wasn't any of the Brazels, that it was actually the nearest neighbor's son, Timothy Proctor, a son of Floyd and Loretta Proctor, 7 years old at that time, who was actually with Brazel. And then, as kids were at that time, and as quickly in other neighborhoods where they would get on their bikes and go back to, you know, to the scene of the crime, so to speak, he and other young boys would get on horseback and quickly go out and reinvestigate the site and take away pieces, and then eventually were with Brazel when he discovered this secondary site, the site Tom mentioned earlier, about 2.5 miles east of the debris field. And as Proctor would later tell his mother, after having denied us and refused to talk to even his own family about what had happened, he would describe to her, "This is where Mac found something else."
Yeah, let's back up that story, because I think it's maybe the most compelling story in the book. This guy, Timothy D. Proctor, you guys pursue him relentlessly, trying to get him to talk, knowing that he was there, knowing that he held this stuff, that he took other people to the site. Tell the story of how you tried to get him to talk and how you eventually got the information.
Well, what's interesting, George, is the fact that it was his own mother, Loretta, who had fingered him as a participant from the very beginning. And as we would get additional corroboration from neighbors, D was always the one who would just flatly deny it. In fact, there were times we would arrive at the ranch house, and no sooner than we would enter the home, the ranch home, we'd hear a pickup truck racing down the driveway, getting away from us. Or it was another occasion where his mother finally would say, "Well, I'm sorry, boys, you just missed him." And there he would step into the room all groggy, just waking up from sleep, and quickly turn around and, again, walk away from us with nothing additional to say. Kevin Randall finally, serendipitously, had an opportunity to speak with him over the phone before he would die, to which he finally admitted that, yes, he was with Mac Brazel upon discovering the debris field, that, yes, he did handle some of that actual wreckage, and, yes, there was no doubt in his mind that it was not manufactured here. That it was
this guy had to almost like PTSD symptoms through his life, it seems. I mean, he had a lot of personal problems that seemed to be stemming from guilt or secrecy or something. But as you describe in the book, he finally, I mean, his mom told you he knows something, and then he finally leveled with her, right? He took her to the site.
He took her out to the site. She had a, as far as a blood clot in her neck, which became life-threatening, and who should show up one day but mom, I need to show you something. And as they drove out to that area, he thought that she thought he would just finally confide to her that this is, yes, I was with Mac when he discovered all the wreckage. But he drove her to this other site, this other location atop this bluff, where he made that rather cryptic remark about Mac finding something else. But that's all he would say about it. That's all he would ever acknowledge. And yet, all neighbors and all other witnesses involved would point to the fact that whatever Timothy D was involved with, he was white as a ghost when he came home one day. He did finally admit that, yes, the military had talked to him, but as far as his cooperating with us or even his family, he just would sooner get in his truck and race down the road or just flatly deny it. And for a lifetime, that to this day, his family still either suggests, well, he obviously didn't say or see anything because he never confided to us, or we lost an opportunity because you had a witness who could paint a masterpiece, who could not only paint what he observed at the debris field, but then what he also saw at that site where Mac Brazel found something else.
It's a pretty sad story how it ends up for him. And there's a lot of sad stories in this book of people who want to do the right thing, but are basically beaten into submission, threatened, threats that hung over their heads for the rest of their lives. And we're going to get into some specific examples of that in a little bit. And in the next hour, I want you guys to sort of trace the beginning of the cover-up, how it started, the kinds of threats that these witnesses were hit with, and how it affected their lives. So we're talking with Tom Carey and Don Schmidt, author of the new book, The Children of Roswell, A Seven-Decade Legacy of Fear, Intimidation, and Cover-Ups. And we'll be coming back in just a moment with more Coast to Coast AM.